babies of the web. But some web, the second website you saw that elicited a collective gasp as we looked at the depravity in which people are capable, not just Becca, but people out there on the internet. Suppose indeed there was a sovereign out there, call it the United States government. And the United States government, all three branches, have gotten together to decide that certain pieces of writing available over the internet are in fact actionable. They can be deemed illegal. Now, we could spend several weeks arguing the constitutionality of law that would prohibit a site like Babies of the Web. But you can imagine, with the Supreme Court going the way it is, and the visceral reaction one sees looking at that kind of site, that it could be successfully criminalized. So at least put aside the constitutional debate that we can have and not resolve about whether or not the United States would ever collectively, among all three branches, say this is illegal, and presume that we wish to find it so. Once we find it illegal, how do we actually get rid of it? And what are the problems of getting rid of it? So for example, Jessica Blumenfeld, are you here today? Hello, you're on Carol, right? Excellent. If we knew it was illegal under United States law to post a site that contains pictures of little kids and depicts them in certain ways, you're the Attorney General, you've just gotten this law passed, you're now responsible for enforcing it. What's the issues you hit as you actually try to get rid of that site? You want to cause that site not to exist on the internet anymore. Wow, we're going to have to either yell. We have that capable mic. Apparently these Henry Kissinger mics go on Friday, so next Monday will be a completely different atmosphere. So, go ahead.
The problem is going to be where we're going to sue these, where we're going to sue to see anywhere that his website reaches us in any state where someone can access his website or...
Now, is this an embarrassment of riches problem? Is there so many places to sue him? How can we choose which? Or is it the opposite problem? We don't know where to sue him. None, no particular event is suitable.
Well, I guess it's depends on what you determine is the answer. If like, you know, for the case we looked at, for the more recent cases on the website for internet technology issues, really said there has to be two of the cases where the court came down saying, yeah, there's jurisdiction here, dealt with places where, as you said, sort of entered into a contract, somebody who in the getting onto a service had signed on to go under the, you know, law of Ohio. So it doesn't seem like just it's enough that just having the website be accessible from a certain date is what I'm bringing in the court there.
But suppose the law says something like it shall be unlawful to publish websites with the following characteristics: depiction of children, engaging in particular acts, or discussion of such acts around pictures of children, and, you know, 6 months in jail as a misdemeanor, or appropriate fine if you are convicted of actually placing such information on the web. And we have Robert Toombs's hypothetically put this information up, falls under the ambit of the act, substantively speaking, that the website qualifies as something penalized, let's assume. And if we knew that he lived in Chicago, you just go to the phone book, Robert Toombs, Chicago, Illinois. Any problem with just bringing the case in Chicago and going after it? You can put this information on the internet, you live in Chicago, so you can't worry about jurisdiction. This is where you live. End of story. Do I think this is a good question or something?
No. My gut instinct is to want to be able to get it tracking down in Chicago.
Yeah, you send out Risco and Logan, and they go get the guy, and they say you're under arrest for under Title 18, section blah blah blah. You put the stuff on the internet. That's it. Now, what is he going to plead? He can say what? You're not jurisdiction over me. How can he say? What argument can he make if there's no jurisdiction over me? Yeah, feel free to call on a co-panelist if you want. Co-counsel. That was Julie Buxton. Are you here? Aha. Far from the mic, but Well, couldn't they just, you know, federal postal inspectors have such boring days. They're sitting there looking at packages and kind of shake them. And every so often, to break the monotony, they log on the web and look at porn. And when they find porn that might run afoul of federal law, they then get the gears in motion to bring charges against the person in question, right? So all we need to do, if we don't have to do some empirical study to see if people in Chicago have actually looked at a Tootsie site, we just send the postal inspector over to look at it from Chicago. He does. Boom, there's somebody in Chicago that sees it. If that was your worry, isn't that the end of the story?
Probably. I think somebody can't get it in Chicago. But the issue gets broader. We have things like people say Tootsie lives in China.
So let's ask that then. We actually look at the phone book and says, you call up Tootsie's number to arrange for service and process to him and send the text at the right time. It says, we're sorry, the phone is disconnected, please direct all inquiries to country code, boom, off to China. And that's where he lives. Is there any problem with jurisdiction over him in China? What's the problem with Tootsie?
I think we don't have personal jurisdiction over him.
So if your Tootsie's lawyer, you'll come in and you'll say, you have no jurisdiction over me. I don't wish to just simply hide, although that might be a problem. We just can't find him. But even supposing we could find him, he's on a visit to the United States on a stopover, or that wonderful case where the planes over North Dakota, at that moment, federal marshals in time to walk up to aisle 3 and arrest the guy under North Dakota law or something. So you get him somehow, and then he defends and says, wait a minute, there's no jurisdiction over me. And that's a legal argument, right? The United States may have him physically in clutches but decide not to assert jurisdiction because the reach of the court would be beyond the proper boundaries of the sovereign. These are talking about, the first objection you raise is a procedural limit. Let me stop right there, a procedural limit. We think the procedural fairness, this is now harking back to first year civil procedure, sorry, bring up some painful memories, but procedural limits say that sometimes, even if we can get you on our sites, it's not fair to hail you into court here. And then you get into all sorts of lawyer death, that's purposeful. We have all sorts of tests. And Toots might say, look, you know, when my house burns down, no American fire department puts it out. When my home gets bombed, no American plane is defending it. Therefore, I shouldn't have to sue for American law. And under that procedural limits test, what do you think the answer of the ADA is going to be?
I think the answer is that he doesn't have, he can't get
it. We can't get it. So General Noriega doesn't avail himself of fire protection from the United States, nor from defense from the American forces. He's minding his own business in Panama, and yet somehow we believe we have personal jurisdiction over him when he happens to show up in Miami under escort by armed soldiers.
Let me ask a question. You make the argument that by using the web and having a site that's easily accessible in the United States, he's availing himself of the law. But I think the court probably would find it. Or maybe they really want to.
Well, we know the Noriega case, right? I mean, Noriega raised personal jurisdiction as an issue, like, hello, I was minding my business in Panama. And the answer was, you may have been, but you were doing things that had an impact over here. You were sending drugs, you had reasons to know, like worldwide Volkswagen, who rolled into the United States at some point. And as a result, Tootsie, when you put up your site, even if you live in China and the server's in China and everything is in China, once it goes on the internet, you've got to know that the Americans looking at it. Here's evidence that the Americans looked at it. Therefore, don't we have procedural reason to exercise jurisdiction over you? You are availing yourself of the United States eyeballs of our people on this territory, and therefore you lose.
I think I would make the argument that I didn't reasonably expect to be held in the court in Chicago. And as a result, can be held in court anywhere in the world, which is sort of like the blue sack argument. But as a result, everyone can be held in court everywhere if they have any.
Yes, this is the conflict of jurisdictions problem under procedural fairness. What it turns out to be, of course, is when it's to the advantage of, say, the United States, to assert jurisdiction as far as possible because of impacts of particular activity done far away to have impact home. And the internet is one means of having impact home from activity far away. Then they say that's enough to achieve procedural jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over somebody. But then you raise the question of, if that's sauce for us, isn't it sauce for anybody else? And I don't know how many have ever seen Raph Howard Koble. He's the kindly gentleman that I mentioned before who runs the Intellectual Property, of course, subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. Very nice and southern guy. And he opened a hearing on intellectual property and jurisdiction and the internet by saying, suppose I'm in Tennessee and I have a website that sells Tennessee mementos. And suddenly the Bulgarians don't like it. You know, is it fair that mom and pop of Tennessee should have to answer in a Bulgarian court for defective merchandise from their site? I took him to be saying no. He didn't think so. But that does lead to a problem of multiple jurisdictions. I remember this actually from my CompuServe days. At some point, a rule came down from on high, the CompuServe administrative apparatus saying, by the way, as a CompuServe system operator, as one of the customers is running a small area on CompuServe, if you choose to offer your members a contest, you must first ensure that the contest has been approved or at least is legal in every single jurisdiction in which it might be viewed. And there's some inquiries about Botswana law as it relates to lotteries and giveaways, and then people decide they're not going to have contests anymore. So this is the slowest ship in the convoy can slow down the whole thing problem. Indeed, that segues into substantive limits as well. You can end up with multiple laws in play. If you do a certain activity that has impact all over the place, you can imagine directly conflicting laws. Some countries actively encouraging this activity, they like it for some reason. Other countries saying, absolutely not, we don't allow it. And then what will happen is, again, in the solo ship of the convoy, somebody has to know all the laws and will engage in an activity that at least any powerful country objects to. And that means that who cares what this one thinks? That's what the practical analysis is going to be by somebody. Let them come get me. I don't tend to visit there very often. But I do worry if the European Union doesn't like something, if Singapore doesn't like something, that might be an issue if the United States doesn't like something. Okay, so that's part of the question of jurisdiction, of the puzzle as to if you're trying to wear the hat of the United States of America, say, are you in favor of expansive interpretations of jurisdiction so you can get Tutsi when he's in China for doing an activity that clearly is bearing on American citizens, or are you upset because you have constituents who are mom and pop running their store and you don't want their business or commerce to have to be curtailed? Singapore is another great example. Singapore has much stricter censorship of the press, penalties, legal penalties, for saying bad things about Singapore. And as a policy, you may not wish to recognize that jurisdiction. Okay, let's see what the next thing is. How can the sovereign's power be effectively asserted within those boundaries? I just want to highlight we're looking at different issues. One is, presuming you have the guy in front of you, do you actually want to assert the jurisdiction? Does fairness dictate that you can and should do that? And if you do believe it should, then how do we avoid the problem of everybody else wants to do it too, once anybody puts anything on the internet? The second question is much more a practical question. If you are Botswana and you wish to assert your jurisdiction, the stuff is coming into your country, how do you effectively prevent the activity from taking place or penalize the person when the person is in fact quite hard to reach? That is a practical question of jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is the exercise of raw power. Once you've decided, you won't refrain from doing so as a government, versus the first question. Okay, questions on that punch? Alrighty. I want to turn then to a couple of case studies, some of which were in the readings. And one is the ICANN Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy. Before ICANN came along, before the UDRP came along, the very problems of jurisdiction that we just mapped out quickly, even with Tootsie's website, happened with domain names. Powerful interests were upset that domain names they thought they had some claim to, now of course what they have a claim to is a matter perhaps under a given sovereign's law, but they believed somehow they had a claim to it and somebody else had reserved the name. They would go to Network Solutions, the registered say names in comment.org and say, we believe that we are using this name, And Network Solutions had to figure out what to do. And they actually had a series of different policies trying to figure out how to deal with this. Several lawsuits were attempted against them to get them to fork over the name, and pretty consistently those lawsuits said, Network Solutions is just the middle person. We're not going to demand that they make substantive adjudications about who is doing what. Maybe they have a first-come, first-served policy. Maybe they'll benefit, but we as courts aren't going to hasten to order Network Solutions to do anything about it. Network Solutions later came up with a policy that said, if you can show a trademark registration from any sovereign in the name that you are challenging that someone else has, we will place it on hold, and neither of you will get it until somehow you settle it. That also wasn't deemed to be a satisfactory solution by many parties who had fights over these names, whether on the defendant end or on the prosecuting end, such as it is. And ICANN, in many ways, was inspired by the idea of we've got to fix this problem. And part of that propaganda is jurisdictional. Whose law do we use to settle who the name belongs to? If you know whose law to use, how do you figure out how to take somebody in Bulgaria and properly and fairly hail them into court in New York City, if that's where it's going to be, and get them to answer to the name they've registered? So, bless you. This is the point where we can introduce our mystery guest. We have with us Mr. Andrew McLaughlin. Andrew McLaughlin is a graduate of Harvard Law School, a fellow of the Berkman Center, and somebody who is now the senior policy advisor to ICANN, the interim chief financial officer. We also have one point the corporate secretary.
It's like any other .com, like everybody has their own time.
Okay. So he's also the ICANN evangelist that you're about to meet. Somebody who's been very much caught up with ICANN stuff. Just to remind you, you make any administrative announcements. You said would have reason to stay to the end of the class. Administrative announcements. But Andrew, thank you for joining us. Is there anything I'm missing in your bio that's relevant?
Nothing except my checkered past friendship with Jonathan that goes back about 15 years now.
It's true. Okay. Andrew is with us. Mr. McLaughlin, I should say. Here's the ICANN website. You have been personally responsible for much of the implementation of the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy. At least the way I've set it up, just walk me through. How does the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy fix this problem that ICANN heard about the main
English? Okay, here are a couple of bullet points about the UDRP that are useful to keep in mind. The first is that, the only reason that you have an ICANN, which is to say a coordinating body for the domain name and the IP address and systems of the internet, is because of the problem of uniqueness.
There's Andrew and Ben, so all the time together.
You can click the back button. The problem of uniqueness is what drives the existence of ICANN. In other words, for the internet as we know it to function properly, domain names and the underlying IP numbers that form the backbone of the routing architecture of the internet must be unique. For the same reason that phone numbers have to be unique, domain names and IP addresses have to be unique. So when the US government decided that they were going to transition policy making functions for those resources into the private sector, one of the conditions that they attached was that the new body that does the coordination functions had to attempt somehow to try to resolve the emerging and growing conflicts between trademarks and domain names. As you know, a trademark is a legal protection over the use of a name. It is a very bad match to the domain name system because the problem of uniqueness means that there can only be one instantiation of a given name in the domain name system. And the problem of trademarks, trademarks are defined and enforced according to region, according to industry. In other words, there can be a Joe's Bar and Grill in Austin, Texas, and a Joe's Bar and Grill in Boston, Massachusetts, and a Joe's Bar and Grill in Buenos Aires, all of which get a trademark. But because they're in different geographic regions, the trademarks can be coextensive. Same thing with Joe's Bar and Grill that serves food in Boston, Joe's Bar and Grill that prepares carburetors in Boston. Either one of those businesses can have a trademark. Anyway, on the domain name system, only one person can get the name. So the UDRP, Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, was developed by ICANN, implemented for .com, .net, and .org only. So no, it does not fundamentally solve the problem of maybe the kitty site, because of course, simply pulling a domain name away from the user of the provider of the website doesn't kill the speech. The speech can continue under some other domain name. It's a highly distributed system. Anybody can get a domain name. The only thing we're talking about here is a particular set of characters that you can't.
But so, just walk us through how it works with .com.net. How is it that ICANN is in a position to mandate that anything can happen?
Okay, so in .com.net, the process of allocating domain names to customers, to users of the internet, takes place in a sort of three-layered process. At the very top of the hierarchy is ICANN with its authority over what's called the root zone file. The root zone file is the file that says, okay, if you want to know about .com, user, browser, go ask this computer over here. If you want to know about .uk, then you go ask that computer. That's how you resolve queries. So ICANN maintains the file that tells you that. Under .com, there is a registry, which is the authoritative database of names and numbers. And underneath the registry are registrars that provide registration services to customers. So ICANN has contracts at each level of this hierarchy. We essentially choose the provider of registry services for .com.net North, and we authorize the companies that are allowed to compete to provide registrar-level services. So the registry is the authoritative database. There can only be one authoritative database because of the problem of uniqueness that we mentioned earlier. And then there can be many competing companies that provide registration services. ICANN has contracts with each one of those. So we require in our contracts that the registrars resolve disputes over domain names through the Uniform Dispute Resolution policy. So that's how ICANN gets its authority, it's through contracts.
Okay, so we have a policy that's in the meetings, and it essentially says, wouldn't it be nice that if somebody doesn't like that you have a particular domain name they think belongs to them, under this policy, they have certain recourse. They can launch a protest of a certain kind. They get to pick certain arbitrators who are in turn accredited by ICANN to arbitrate. The arbitrators think about it. They're given some factors to consider. You can see the factors in the policy. They think hard. They make a decision. And then their decision is binding. What does it mean to say their decision is binding? Well, suppose I have a domain name, Barcelona.com. I registered that first come, first serve a long time ago, just like Boston.com. I have Barcelona.com. The city of Barcelona believes that it should have the name, it comes to me, and I offer to sell it to them for a certain number to say that it doesn't want to buy them for any price. So as a result, it files under the UDRB. Now, why do I even have to show up to challenge it?
Why does it challenge it?
I'm the respondent. They sent me this letter and they say, we're now, or you've made us angry, now we're going to take you to arbitration under the UDRB.
Well, the reason that you should show up is because the registrar has to respect the wishes of the arbitrator. So if you fail to show up and they decide against you, you will lose the registration to the domain name.
So, in essence, when I got my domain name, I had to get it from somebody. I get it from a registrar. And when I got it from the registrar said, I'm not giving you the name until you sign the following contract. And the contract says, you agree to submit to and abide by the decision of the Uniform Dispute Resolution Procedure Panel in the event that somebody challenges your name. So I'm now, it seems, contractually obliged to have to abide by the decision. And you say, if the decision goes against me, whether or not I agree, I start abiding by it, I've agreed to, but let's say, you know, no, I refuse to abide, come and get it. I don't actually have the domain name in a locked chest in my house. Instead, somehow the registrar is the one that knows to tell the world at large that the domain name really goes to my website. And that registrar will switch it over to the winner.
The registrar highlights your name, hits the delete key, and then types in the name of the new registrar.
So my act of civil disobedience is somewhat pure.
It's going to be difficult.
Now, why does the registrar do that? Why doesn't the registrar say, I don't want to do that. Maybe I'm a new kind of registrar. I call myself the Freedom Registrar. And I'm going to register names, and I'm not going to hit the leak keys. And therefore, I'm going to sell more names, because nobody likes to have their name taken away, and ask the customer who wants to pay me right now, What's to stop that registrar from just saying, forget it?
You won't have a contract with ICANN. You therefore won't be allowed to place names into the database.
I see. So before a registrar can start hitting delete keys or insert keys and parsing out names, the registrar has to sign a contract with ICANN. Yeah. And the contract with ICANN says, I agree that if one of these UDRP panels goes against somebody that registered with me, I'm going to delete me.
That's exactly right. Registrars have to abide by the UDRP for constant purposes.
Now, suppose the registrar is good friends with the user who registered. The panel holds against the user, and the registrar says, you know I signed that contract, but I'm going to do a little civil disobedience. I refuse to hit the delete key. Forget it. Take me to court if you think you can make this scrap of paper that I signed under duress stand up. What happens next?
Well, what happens then is it's a standard contract action. You would terminate their accreditation as a registrar.
So you sort of rip their badge off the side of their...
It's basically like pulling the plug. You know, we disconnect them from that authoritative database. They can no longer put names in. And there's a procedure for reassigning all the names that they've already got in there to some other registrar.
I see. So if the registrar says, I'm going to be civil and disobedient, it turns out the registrar doesn't have the names in the lockbox either. So the registrar finds that somebody else just gets asked to hit the delete key, and that's it.
We highlight with our mouse the name of the registrar.
And you hit the delete key. I see. Now, is it actually ICANN that does that?
It's actually the registry.
The registry? What's the registry?
The registry is the authoritative database of names and contact number.
That's Network Solutions.
It is.
So you would call up, you as ICANN ex machina, and say to Network Solutions, oh, we got a real squeaker here. This registrar, we've yanked its accreditation. Please prevent that registrar from hitting delete and insert and assign to this new registrar. And Network Solutions would say, yes, sir. And no matter how civilly disobedient the registrar wanted to be, that's it.
That's it.
Now, what if the registry was friends with the registrar, who's friends with the user? The registry says, you know, enough. I cast off these shackles. I've got the names in my database, and they are in my lockbox. I've met the armed guard that boringly sits by the hard disk and guards these names. Forget it, ICANN. We are not going to turn off that registrar. As a result, the registrar is going to turn off the user, and the name will not be switched. Then what happens?
They would then lose their accreditation as the registry and somebody else to run the database.
I see. So ICANN would then yank Network Solutions' approval and assign somebody else. And because ICANN controls the root zone, does ICANN control the root zone?
It's shared. Well, it's shared operational control right now. Effectively, we have policy control within about 6 months. Operational control will also shift. Re-architecting the root zone system.
Where is this root zone?
The root zone 5 is maintained on 13 root servers that are scattered around.
And where's the main one? The one that all the others listen to?
Right now, they take their authoritative updates from their letter A through M. The authoritative updates come from A, which is maintained but not controlled by Network Solutions.
Gotcha. And in 6 months?
The way the sequence works right now is that we make changes to the root zone file. We send it to the U.S. government. The U.S. government hits the forward button on their computer, sends it to Network Solutions, and Network Solutions executes the update.
And if Network Solutions were to say, I don't feel like it, they'd be in big trouble with the United States government.
That's right.
And in 6 months from now?
And with me.
And with me. Formidable. If the United States government, I'm sorry, 6 months from now, where's the root server go?
So what's going to happen 6 months from now is that the 13 root servers are no longer going to take their authoritative updates from one of the root servers. They're going to take it from what we call a dedicated primary, which will be a machine stealthily hidden on the net, known as the 13 root servers. That'll be maintained by us.
So you can't tell me where the root server's going to go?
I'm not telling you.
It could be in here. It could be in this very room.
It could be my laptop. Probably not, though.
All right. So we asserted the problem before. We now see at least how the mechanics of the UDRP can see to it that somebody registering or renewing a domain name can be be dispossessed of it through this process, ultimately controlled by ICANN. Because it's ICANN that can decide whether to gain or provide accreditation at the registry or registrar level on the basis of contracts that ICANN writes out.
That's right. Now keep in mind that it's a somewhat more interestingly distributed system than that, because on the other hand, the contracts don't allow us to have any particular authority over any particular domain name. For example, we can't order network solution trading registrars to do anything that a specific domain name. We have a non-discrimination clause in our contracts which prevent us from issuing what are essentially bills of attainder regarding a particular domain name.
And if a registry or registrar didn't like the way we thought you were singling out a particular name, they would then argue it out as a matter of contract law in a court of competent jurisdiction.
That's the idea. I mean, we're supposed to sit atop an architecture of dispute resolution and not make any specific decisions about any specific domain names. We don't have that authority.
And do these contracts specify a choice of venue for lawsuits? They
do. They're in Los Angeles, California.
Los Angeles, California. So I could be a Korean registrar. If I want to complain about something ICANN's doing, I am contractually bound to bring the action in Los Angeles, California.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, there are arbitration clauses, too. In fact, you probably would be required to arbitrate it rather than sue.
There's a UDRP for the UDRP.
Yeah, standard arbitration clause. It's super cool. The UDRP, keep in mind, is not about any domain name dispute in any way, shape, or form. It's about a very specific and narrow brand of what we call abuse of bad faith cyber squatting. But one party has a domain name, the other side has no legitimate interest, and there's evidence of bad faith or abuse. Footnote is legitimate interest include not only competing trademarks, but fair uses such as parody clauses and so forth. So this only goes to a very noxious, what's perceived to be a very noxious kind of behavior, registering a domain name that ought to be somebody else's, and then trying to extort money for it.
Like that terrible Barcelona.com act.
I can't comment on specific decisions, but some of them are clearly not being resolved correctly. And that's to be expected. I mean, there have been about 1,200 decisions under the UDRP, and I guarantee you that some of them will be misapplications of policy.
So if there's a bad application of the UDRP, what do I do?
You go to court. So the UDRP, notice that we don't call it arbitration, and there's a reason for that. Arbitration in almost every Western legal system is given a special private place that says if you agree to arbitrate your problems in the contract, you cannot then avail yourselves of the court. So in the United States, only if you can say that the arbitration itself was barred by fraud or something.
So the Federal Arbitration Act, 1927.
That's absolutely right. And most Western countries have something parallel to that. The UDRP was written very specifically and very carefully so that it does not include court jurisdiction. That means that if you lose, you can go to court. And the name will not be transferred as soon as anybody brings a lawsuit. They will not be transferred until the court reaches its resolution.
But what sorts of argument do you make in this court?
You would challenge the dispute resolution and say that it was not done according to the policy. And if the policy is part of the contract, you're basically suing on your contract with the registrar and saying that the registrar is transferring the name for reasons other than those specified in the contract.
And does that contract say where you have to sue?
There is actually a fairly complex jurisdiction clause where you can sue either where the registry is or where the domain name holder, registrar is, or the domain name holder is. You can pick one or the other of those.
And if you are the domain name holder, that means you can sue at home. If you live in Germany and you don't like the result of a domain name uniform dispute procedure lodged against you, you go to the German court, and under German contract law?
Yes, the agreement does not specify whose law has to be applied. So I would say if you're in Germany, you could make a good argument for suing under German contract law. It would be up to a German court to decide under its principles which law it will apply.
So you can see how the UDRP has solved and simplified so many of the problems we just talked about with respect to jurisdiction. Yes, Rachel.
I'm sorry. What to stop someone from saying, forget the UDRP, I don't know if you're fair shape, and going to court?
Nothing. You can totally do that. You can waltz right into court. I mean, if the challenger can go right into court and sue for the domain name, and in fact, a lot of big businesses do that. Like the Olympics is suing left and right. They just jump on the UDOP. At the same time, the defendant can immediately go to court once the UDRP gets filed. You have no obligation to wait until it gets resolved.
So these are sort of parallel jurisdictions.
It's intended to be a cheap, easy way to resolve the worst kinds of abuses of the domain name system without keeping anybody from the protection of the courts.
Jason.
Okay, if UDRP does anything, it's got two parallel tracks, but you can always bypass UDRP.
That's right.
So, why would anybody who has committed something egregious go through UDRP when they could forum shop by setting up their domain anywhere they wanted in, say, Botswana, where they know that they can bribe the Botswana judge and get the judgment that they want? What is the recourse for the copyright holder?
All right, a couple of points. First of all, copyright has nothing to do with this.
I'm sorry, trademark.
The choice to avail yourself of the UDRP is made by the challenger, right? Not by the defendant. The defendant has no choice. The domain name holder gets an email that says, "Hi, you're being challenged by the defendants now." So at that point, there's nothing the defendant can do to stop the UDRP process. Now you can moot it by just waltzing into court and bringing a preemptive suit. And the answer is nothing. There's nothing to prevent you from going into a Botswana court to try to get a judgment. On the other hand, the challenger, if they're smart, will go into the national court of the registrar and try to get a conflicting judgment in that jurisdiction. I mean, this is an interesting example of where cyberspace changes nothing. You know, this is a commercial contract problem, the likes of which have been seen many times in the past in different industries. It's just much more much starker relief by the nature of the transactions we're talking about and how common they are. I mean, think about it. You can have a dispute where the registrant is in South Africa, the challenger is in North Korea, the registry is in Virginia, the registrar is in Argentina, and the arbitrator sits in Geneva. That's not unusual in this case. And in that sort of situation, trying to avail yourself of courts in those different jurisdictions is more or less impossible. You can't resolve this through traditional channels. And therefore, cyberspace in this context is totally the same as all kinds of other commercial spaces.
But the body of law, I mean law is lowercase law, it's not sovereign's law, but the body of jurisprudence that can be drawn upon as an arbitrator to figure out whether to transfer the name is sui generis. Its own category is coming from the factors of ICANN. The lay down of the UDRP and just apply it. And then if somebody wants to challenge the challenge in court as somebody who had the name taken away, there's going to be a contract action about whether somehow the contract was originally fair in the first instance or whether the process by which the name was taken away was true to the terms of the contract and really met those factors or not, rather than an action about the particular sovereign's law as to who should have what name.
That's the right regime of contract.
Follow-up question.
The follow-up question is, who did ICANN listen to decide whether to pull the plug on the site?
Say that again.
Okay, we've got the same conflict of law issue. Who decides? Which court is right? You know, ICANN's got to pull the plug on someone or not.
The
registry has to.
Right. So keep in mind this distributed structure. ICANN can't tell anybody to remove any name from the domain name system. But let's do a problem, right? Let's suppose you've got a holder in South Africa, a challenger in North Korea, and the registry is in Argentina. The registrar is in Argentina. South African, you know, went to a website hosted in Argentina, just clicked on it, gave the credit card number, got the domain name out of it. The registry in Virginia, you know, Network Solutions, they basically just take instructions from the registrar. So they don't really factor into this analysis very well. The registrar in Argentina is going to respond first and foremost to Argentinian courts. And so if they get a judgment under our policy, if they get a judgment from a court of competent jurisdiction, South Africa, written order from me. They're supposed to listen to me. If, however, they get a conflicting judgment from the local courts, then obviously you have to follow the law of the place where you are.
I think will forms up for a registrar in a jurisdiction where they know that, where they think they can win.
That is a distinct possibility. Absolutely.
Yeah, Aaron.
I
just goes to public accountability and
volume.
My question goes to public accountability of the UDRT process, and I'm wondering, first of all, whether there's are the decisions made by the arbitrators precedential meaning is there a record of the basis for the decision?
Yeah, they're all posted on the web. So all the decisions are publicly available.
So are arbitrators bound by record?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless they decide they are.
They can look to guidance. They can look, the way that this works is you can be persuaded by the reasoning of the prior opinion. But as you said before, this is more like a civil law scheme where the rules exist, and what you do is you apply the rules to the facts without having to resolve difficult questions of law. Sometimes arbitrators look to canons of interpretation, for example, from their own legal system. Sometimes they look to court cases to see how other courts resolve similar questions.
And where are these arbitrators? Where do they come from?
There are four different organizations that provide dispute resolution services, which is what we label, what you would ordinarily call arbitration. And basically, we just picked four different organizations that came out
of the yellow pages.
They are arbitration service providers. There is one called the National Arbitration Forum, which also calls all retired federal judges based in Minneapolis. There is one called the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a UN affiliated treaty organization based in Geneva.
What is its current in?
This context will apply to policy.
I see that as organization, is it kind of charter?
Sure it does. I mean, it's the World Intellectual Property Organization, so I'm sure it's chartered and also promoting intellectual property.
So why would that end? Why would that end?
Why would that end? Mention
it. Why would that end? Two ends of your hands. Not the World Wrestling
Federation. There are two others, and let me say, one of the biggest downsides to UDRP, one of the most cogent criticisms that something that I've been thinking about how to solve, the idea that if you have four competing dispute resolution service providers and the complainant is the one who gets to pick which provider they're going to use, then you have a built-in incentive to be pro-complainant so that the complainant will pick you because that's what money at stake.
You get paid money to be by the complainant.
That's correct. The complainant pays
sends you a check and says, now give me an informed decision.
That's correct. So of course, this is how arbitration works ordinarily, right?
Right.
But anyway, it's one of the sort of troubling things. Now, one of the ways in which we solved it.
Oh, here's their charter, by the way. Back up a second. Their charter, LIPO is responsible for the promotion of the protection of intellectual property throughout the world through cooperation among states, the administration of various multilateral treaties dealing with the legal and administrative aspects of intellectual property. Oh, yeah, here's your question. Sorry, I thought I'd ask an answer, please.
But when there's a new area of law, the precedential Supreme Court helps to establish a set of expectations for people that need to avail themselves of the law. And I'm just wondering about how I can fix the arbitration system, which is not precedential, in an area that seems to not have a lot of law that arbitrators can apply. How is that going to set up a set of uniform expectations for internet users that don't maybe need
well, it's basically a question of how clearly can you draft the rules. I mean, because all you're supposed to be doing in this case is if you have an application of the rules, does one side, there are three questions. Does the challenger have a trademark? Yes or no? Does the domain name holder have no legitimate interest? There's a list of things that might constitute legitimate interest. And then lastly, is there evidence of bad faith or abuse? And the form that almost always takes is an email from the domain name holder to the challenger saying, hi, I've got, you know, Walmart.com, and I'll sell it to you for $100,000. That's bad faith and abuse. So the thing that I'm worried about at the moment, actually, is if there are inconsistent applications of those rules by the dispute resolution providers, then you need to clarify the rules so that it clears it up. But I think that the I wouldn't be comfortable with the presidential system because that gives essentially too much, it puts too much on the shoulders of the first arbitrator who happens to be. I'd rather do it in a more open way because we have, you know, a big open sort of participatory process for drafting these rules that includes pro-trademark people, anti-trademark people, and so forth that will butt heads until they finally reach broad consensus on a set of rules. The better thing to do is to draft the rules more clearly.
Laura, and Claire.
Okay, Claire. No. YouTube, I mean, this, you know, you do the best you can. This is not, this is a parallel, mandatory but non-binding alternative to court litigation. I would be more concerned with it if this was the only crack that people got at the app. It's not. And in addition, I mean, keep in mind, the domain name system is highly distributed. If you don't have one domain name, you can get another one. We're just talking about which particular combination of letters are used to route traffic to your server.
What
percentage of people
will
use the
VIP
also sign up for support?
That's a good question, actually. I don't know what the statistics are. There was a good National Law Journal to the study of the first 1,000 decisions.
The first 1,000 decisions, and how much time was that?
We started in earnest in January.
So since January, there was 1,000 decisions handed down under this policy. And about how many of those resulted in the transfer of the name?
The aggregate figure is, well, the aggregate overall figure is somewhere in the 70% range. But there's a huge number that are uncontested. Of the ones that are contesting, the transfer rate is somewhere in the higher 50s.
Gotcha.
What's
the
process of the hearing that the
file
or something?
No, it's all online. So the complainant has a form that the complainant fills out, which basically says, do you have a trademark attach evidence? Does the other side have no legitimate interests? What do you have to say about that? And finally, what's your evidence of that being produced? And that goes to the panelist and also goes to the holder, the debating holder then responds on each of those points, and the whole process takes about 30 or 45 days. It's all.
Yes, can I have my name tag?
Yes.
Jeff.
What factor of jurisdiction around? Why would you ever bring a suit to the domain name holder's jurisdiction when the registrar's jurisdiction seems to come in?
It's a choice that we can make.
Can you repeat the question? I'm not sure if you heard.
Yeah, the choice is why would you ever bring a court action in the jurisdiction of the domain name holder rather than in the jurisdiction of the registrar? The answer is, I don't know.
But the registrar,
yeah, you might live there too.
Does get lost in the domain name holder. You can sue against the registrar.
Yeah, the cases are always resolved without prejudice, right? So if you lose once, you can try again.
Do you try and do
the UDRP cases without prejudice?
Yes.
Did you know Diane was staff? Yeah, there's just it's silent. We didn't think of it. But that's it. I mean, it's interesting.
David,
I guess I'm just curious where this is headed. I mean, it seems like we've had a certain period of time, all the disputes over .com, .org, .net will be over, at least the major ones. And then there's a question about whether there's an expansion to UTLDs. And how long do you expect the current dispute to be going? Is there any sort of status that when it's going to move itself, or you know, what are you going to do with that UTLDs?
Yeah, we're going to launch basically a one-year study starting at the end of this year, just to sort of look at the first year and see how it went. The procedure should only exist as long as it's useful and people are taking advantage of it. I'm actually surprised at the number of cases that have been filed and the rate at which they're being filed is not slowing down.
Is the idea that any new generic top-level domain is approved by ICANN.biz or something through the policy process would be domain subject to uniform dispute resolution process?
Not good yet. We just put out, we're in the middle of an application process right now for new TLDs, and we said, include in your application a detailed description of how you plan to resolve trademark disputes.
And be the same fair on whether we pick you.
Well, the idea is to ask the people who would actually run the registry who gets sued in the absence of some kind of policy to say, what policy do you think would be good? We don't think that everybody's going to be locked into exactly what they say in their application. We might look at all the applications. They're all incidentally posted on the web. You might be interested to poke around, they'll be posted starting on about October 30th.
And just to be clear what he's talking about, right, we had that stalemate we talked about on day one about trying to add new names to root. ICANN is now preparing to do that. And the way it's doing it is to say, fill out a form. You want to be somebody that hosts .biz? Tell us what name you want to host. Fill out all the reasons why you want to do it, how you'll handle intellectual property protection. Give us a whole bunch of information. Staple and check, non-refundable, $50,000 in the form. Send it in. And then don't call us, we'll call you.
Basically, don't call us, we'll call you. Except that they all get publicly posted and there will be comments listed. In other words, we want the public to comment on the different proposals and tell us which ones they think are good or bad for what reasons.
So any of you could apply, so long as you've got $50,000 that you don't mind. Yes, Marianne.
I was wondering what lawyers think from lawyers in this. Are simple enough for people to have a father or a lawyer involved?
Yeah, it's supposed to be lawyer free. But most of the challengers have lawyers prepare a few young claims.
Other questions? Wow, you, sir. Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act, That's another way to get a port order to serve on somebody in that chain of command to get a name assigned to you. And even if you lose, you might try and then you'll be RP'd again and vice versa. The second point is it works as long as you've got enough contracts in place. But also realize, and I think this may, let's just keep rolling along here. Yes, the third point here is the law, which is the public enforcement of those contracts, is complemented by the exercise of the actual raw power. We can have contractual battles anywhere as to whether what somebody signed truly constituted offer acceptance, whether or not you really have to live by those terms, whether they're unconscionable, blah, blah, blah. But in the meantime, you lose your domain name because there's an actual powerful technical cudgel that is used through this cascade of contracts and relationships that ultimately feed back to the control of the root by ICANN to make sure that the loser in one of these UDRP proceedings actually loses the name and sees it assigned to somebody else. That's sort of the possessions is 9/10 of the law thing. You lose your name, and only later you get to go to the court to try to get it back. And this is a fourth observation. This, as a solution, is made much easier when the dispute is over domain names, because after all, we have a technical means of reassigning the name. Even if we have no idea where the person who has a given name lives, or even what the identity is, because he or she provided bogus information to the registrar, who cares? They don't show up. We'll just change the entry into the database to the new person, the challenger, and away we go. So the remedy is a cyber remedy to the cyber problem, such as it is. And is there anything you want to add to that? Before we see if there are any questions?
No, it's just a secret.
Secret, do you still have a question? Anybody?
I'm just kind of curious about the bad faith idea. I can't remember the term. So I was wondering, in order, why not, in order to eliminate the need for attorney bad faith, you'll just put a cap on profits. Is that possible? Just any profits they all.
Price controls in the market. Every mechanic's going to
Look, I mean, I don't see any conceivable way that I can enforce that. There's a secondary market in domain names. It's possible to transfer a name from one party to another, and what money changes hands is the business of the two parties.
But now this is interesting because, as again, a somewhat side note, we know that Network Solutions charges Kaching as the wholesaler, the registry, $9 a pop per year per name. The registrars are entitled to pay much charge on whatever they want. But if you don't like the price offered by one registrar, you simply go to another. All these registrars plug in under Content or into the same database. So if register.com wants to charge you $1 million for a name, you just go find another registrar that charges you less, and ultimately competition would help bring the price down. But it is explicitly prohibited for registries to charge more than the agreed upon rate. Doesn't NSI have a price cap?
$6.
$6. $6. They are not allowed to charge more for any name. It is expected that new registries also will have a price cap. They can only charge so much for name.
Actually, I'm hoping that we're going to see some different models for the economics of new registries.
So somebody from 50,000 might apply get.biz and have a stated business model that says, I will auction off the names to the highest bidder from the kidney of names I have.
Get.tv, which is the country code for Tuvalu, does that now. They just auction every name off.
Yes.
And among the other models that you could imagine would be a non-profit registry. I mean, Network Solutions, as a for-profit company, runs the registry for .com.net.org because of a weird legacy problem that, Jonathan, if you don't know about that, I'll go into detail. But anyway, in an ideal situation, the registry is not a profit-making venture. It's sort of a public service on behalf of the whole internet community. And they would be treating all the registrars equally. There's no particular reason why that's for profit. So personally, I like the idea of non-profit registries that provide equal services to the registrars. And indeed, ICANN's own funding as a non-profit is scalable according to the size of the overall domain name market such that it doesn't vary in its total dollar amount. So in other words, we always get $4 million a year. But the amount
that...
That's
what we're saying.
That's what we say.
I see. You'll never give yourself a price increase.
But I would say built into these contracts are caps on the amount of money that any one party has to pay. So right now, the total aggregate amount of money we can get from content or is about $2.5 million. It can't go higher. So there is actually a built-in contractual price pressure that keeps us from turning into a bloated bureaucracy for some code.
Yes, at some point you should pull up the ICANN organizational chart, which is by Tony Wachowski, if you can find it. It's not entirely a fair chart, but it does make a good view. Maybe this will hurt. Anthony Wachowski next to ICANN organizational chart in Google, you can see if you can find it. Well, this might be ICANN's board chart. You can then do a juxtaposition of the two. Doug, is there a quick question?
Hopefully, yes. I had read about a situation where there are some organizations that basically buy up individuals' names for resale. I'm wondering if individuals have any recourse under UDRPs.
Yes, John Smith. It's a great question, actually. So the UDRP only protects trademarks. So if the U.S. government decided to protect personal names as trademarks, then UDRP would be available. But right now, you can only get a trademark for a personal name if you're using it I forget the magic language, intellectual property law, but using it in commerce. So in other words, Julia Roberts has actually acquired trademark protection for her name for purposes of acting. So nobody else, at least as far as I understand, can use the name Julia Roberts, at least to act in movies.
Even if my name were Julia Roberts, I would no way that.
That's how I understand it. That seems to be seen. But anyway, the anti-cyber squad law that John mentioned earlier does this funny thing where it says that we want to protect personal names to the extent they're protected by trademark. And then it orders the Department of Commerce to study ways to protect personal names. So this is actually going to be one of the big issues, I think, on Capitol Hill in the next year or two, is whether and how to protect the personal names of famous people and particular politicians. They're quite interested in that. It turns out Orrin Hatch's wife's name was Cyber Squad and an author factor, and to point to the old quite a little porn site in the meantime. So he got really upset and started jamming that kind of language in these bills.
Yes,
to
that.
In 10 weeks of being at Harvard this summer, the same company became a repeat player. First it was major US phone company girls.com, then the day White Phone canceled that, it was major cell phone company -girls.com, won that one during the 10 weeks I was there, and by the time I left, they were filing their third WIPO thing. Does the UDRP, in situations like that, where you're gonna get the same two players with essentially the same name in dispute, the third one I believe was Underscore. Is it going to work if they can't have a different remedy other than just merely canceling
the
name?
Yeah, my reaction to cases like that is lighten up. You know, everybody needs to just lighten up about this. I mean, these things happen all the time. So a new company called Verizon's formed, right? And Verizon immediately registers Verizon. Somebody else registers Verizon sucks.com. So Verizon sues that party. And then somebody else registers Verizon really sucks.com. And it goes on endlessly. And then the lesson of that is, as long as Verizon's got Verizon.com, why do they care? You know, people shouldn't care so much about domain names. So that's actually part of what I evangelize, that everybody needs to just sort of take a chill pill about this. Get a name that works and then forget about the rest. I mean, ICANN has taken.
I guess it's not only a new economy organization, it's a new age organization.
Reading the way into 20th perception.
Yeah.
There's ICANN sucks, ICANN, all these different domain names that we're just not caring about. Who cares? You know, people are going to speak what they want to speak on the internet, and the label that you stick on it shouldn't really matter to anybody. So, what you say, if a client was bringing a UDRP after UDRP after UDRP for different iterations, minutely different iterations of the same name, they're just wasting their money foolishly. But it's their right to do that.
Okay, I'm going to shoot here right now.
Because I can't watch. I recently registered ICANN Watch.
Google Watch the Watchers?
Google Watch the Watchers.
Yeah. Okay. I want to shift gears now and look at another potential solution, or attempted solution, the jurisdictional conundrum we're talking about, because the UDRT is I'm glad we got into it, the kind of depth that we have, but again, in some ways, its success is tempered by the fact that it had an easy domain in which to play, domain names. Internet currency was the subject of the dispute so far, and you can see that getting extended. You can see, for example, some hypothetical later extension of the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy that says, by the way, I agree that if a panel of arbitrators finds my site to contain any copyrighted material without authorization, I will lose my domain name. And then that domain name can be taken away. Now maybe you should get a new one for it, and maybe you can just use a direct IP number to get there. But there could still be some pain for loss of your name. Imagine if Amazon.com was caught with copyrighted material on their site under this proceeding, they lose their name as a result. It would be small solace to them, though they could get, you know, Amazon or Amazon.com or something. So let's turn to IKTV, which I offer up as another example of a common jurisdiction and attempted solution. I stall a little bit because I want Ben to walk us through it a bit. Ben, when not doing his work in this room or at Harvard College, Ben was an expert witness in this case, testifying on behalf of the powers that be, Rotary Picture Association of America and others, against portable IKTV. Ben, can you fill us in a bit just on the parameters of the case? What was this about?
Sure. iCreate had set up in its offices in Canada a number of television antennas connected to notebook computers, and then ultimately they upgraded to some pretty high-powered desktops with video encoders making live real videos of American broadcast television. So they had one computer.
So they were right over the border, right? They're like right across the rivers, or river between Buffalo and Canada.
Yeah,
right, there's a lake. It's a waterfall, but yeah. All right, so they set up antennas right over the board.
Yeah,
and they get the feed from Buffalo TV.
And they send it from Buffalo to servers that they had obtained in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They by contract arranged the use of some servers that they didn't own. And they set up the website John showed you a second ago, iCreateTV.com, from which you could access these live streaming videos of a number of channels. You won't be able to get in now. They call it Bono, as we call them.
Yes.
It was quite an exciting time when they were called on the fact that they had no rights to redistribute these images.
But now, the reason they were in Canada was because the Canadians have two laws that we can count on now. And among the laws of Canada has are laws that say that it is illegal to retransmit, particularly if you adulterate it, the pure feed from a television antenna. You're allowed to watch it on a TV, but you may not rebroadcast it even simultaneously to someone else without the permission of the license holder. This was particularly important when cable TV came along, and cable TV wanted to show local broadcast stations in addition to the regular cable channels. And originally they just took the feed and put it in because their customers liked it. And the people with the feed said, no, you have to pay us. Said, pay us, you know, people can just watch this stuff from an antenna. Why should we have to pay you? And they said, because we should. And they got retransmission consent passed in American law that says if you're a cable company, you have to get permission. That was bookended, of course, by Must Carry, which says, if by the way, you don't choose to carry it, but they want you to, you have to carry it. The cable companies lost big on both ends of the analysis. But anyway, in America, it's illegal to retransmit television signals without permission. In Canada, it isn't. So Craig says, I'm not doing anything wrong. In Canada, the signals are straying over the border, and once they're here, they're liberated from the wet blanket of American policy, and then I rebroadcast it on the global internet. Why would it be fair for American law to apply to them?
So there were a few different reasons why the court found in that jurisdiction. And that was not part of the case that I was speaking from 7-month-old memory at this point. Among the relevant factors that the court found to give it jurisdiction were that iCreate had a significant business presence in Pittsburgh. Its domain name was registered to Pittsburgh. Its servers were operated by a company in Pittsburgh. Its entire public and marketing department was sure.
So he's basically one only guy up in Canada who watched the accounts.
That's pretty much right. The CEO and proprietor of the firm was actually barred from coming to Pittsburgh based on a restraining order for his divorce.
Something's better than what I'm saying.
Well, that was in the record, so.
Something's better than what I'm
saying. So all of that's to say that iGrave TV was doing business in Pittsburgh. There was no two ways about it.
So that's how you get personal jurisdiction, right? This is why it's not unfair to tell iGrave, look, you're going to have to answer for what you're doing in a court in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because come on, guys, you really aren't. So on the procedural jurisdiction aspect of the jurisdiction problem, it's not a very interesting case. We just apply first year civ pro and we're done. But now we get into the substantive jurisdiction question, which is, when should a country deem it fair to apply its laws, even though it has properly hailed before it somebody procedurally into the courtroom? And I just said, let's just turn to the panel real quick. Craig Kronheim, what do you say? What's the best argument to say Canada allows this? We understand you're in court, but they're just putting it onto the internet, and they may even arrange it so it launches onto the internet from a Canadian point of entry to the internet. Should the United States say, no, you can't do it?
I guess the argument would be that it was directed towards a service that you provided to the Canadian at least minimal safeguards to try to keep Americans from accessing. So it was really Canadian enterprise. The U.S. government has no right or interest in trying to distribute.
And what were the safeguards?
I think there was something in the read about you had to put in a Canadian exchange of health numbers.
Chair, do you remember the Chair Morgan from the panel?
Yes.
Very good. Yes. Do you remember what these safeguards are? I'm sorry to ask such a specific question, so I'll get into the question.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
All right, so Ben, you're sitting right next to Mike. What were the safeguards? This is what you testified about, right?
It was. Initially, there were no safeguards whatsoever.
So anybody on the internet could come and watch TV over iGrave TV.
Above the link to get into the video, there was text saying, by clicking on this link, I certify that I am a Canadian in Canada.
So there was coordinatory language that said, I promise I'm raising my right hand in front of my screen, I'm a Canadian, and I'm therefore entitled to watch this, right?
In the next version, they improved that to be that text with the button saying, I agree, then get to a screen on which you can click on the link and get into the video.
Which, by the way, it may seem funny, but under much stricter encryption control laws, there was an era in which you would get a Netscape browser with encryption which was barred from export from the United States, and you would have to click a little link that says, I swear that I'm in the United States right now, and then they would send you the permits. But anyway.
The system that I created finally used the court found so seriously inadequate was asking the user for a Canadian area code. The text on the page was, this site is only available to Canadians. If you're a Canadian, please tell us your Canadian area code and also read the following legal term and say,
so why doesn't that block out anybody who isn't?
And then right below that is that if you're having trouble, you can call us in Toronto. Here's our phone number.
That's pretty clever. So, Chara, you're a judge. You're hearing this. I assume the substantive argument is violation of United States law for which you are not allowed to be broadcast up, presumably on American territory. Any American that, I mean, most TV watchers maybe wouldn't qualify, but at least some would get the hint, punch in a Canadian area code, fly brazenly on this I agree button, and thereby be able to watch Buffalo television, even though they are in the United States. That's the travesty we have. What is your holding on this?
What's my holding on this?
Yeah.
Are you asking whether or not I think it's a travesty, or?
I'm asking you the joke. What are you going to do? Do you say, I pay TV, I'm sorry, you have to shut down your service because Americans typing in Canadian area codes can watch it, and therefore you are harming American interests and the law of life?
I would say no, because they have taken at least some steps to try to ensure at least.
They have this goofy
at the most superficial level about, you know, each individual, each American who's getting on the system actually has to lie.
Right.
In order to.
As long as you're making liars out of the people cheating, you're okay. Now, that's somewhat the numerator, the measure of the effort a site is willing to go to try to prevent those covered by a jurisdiction's laws who aren't supposed to see it from getting in. I guess we can also look at the denominator. We say, what is available for you to do to certify citizenship? For example, they could have a system up by which, in order to get the feed, you have to have a password. In order to get a password, you have to send a letter, a postmark from a Canadian city requesting the password, and in turn, it will be mailed back to you at a Canadian address. I mean, they could do that, right?
They could, or they could require a passport number or social security
number. A passport number? We can get into a whole Orwellian system.
Well, you could. I mean, as long as, I mean, you could also give Craig a bit more time, like 6 months, to come up with a much better system.
So does that mean you'd be happy to do as a judge? Is that a fair answer?
That's what I do.
Gotcha. Ben, what did the judge do?
The judge at Knight-Craig's request gave them some weeks, I believe it was 3 weeks, in order to approve their technical systems. And in that time, Knight-Craig installed a system of reverse IP hookups. They take your IP address and attempt to determine whether it was a Harvard computer IP address, in which case, well, Harvard, we know that's in Massachusetts, in the United States, that's not allowed.
Because IP numbers, those serial numbers we talked about the first day, are assigned in big blocks, and we know who has a block, in many instances we can determine if the block was given to somebody on American territory.
That's right.
And you advertise your IP number every time you put it on the internet. So in some sense you advertise your likely geographical location.
Yep. So they were going to go ahead and create some kind of a master list, who's Canadian versus who is not Canadian, based on IP numbers. And it turned out there was already a company called Traceware that had done something substantially the same. Had they been a little bit smarter about it, it might have been a much harder case. Unfortunately, they left a big gaping hole between the web server and the real server that let anyone, even a little bit of knowledge of how real servers operate.
So you basically hacked their system.
I hacked their system by typing a URL into the location bar. The URL was self-evident and formed only by combining text into different parts of the HTML page. So I wouldn't exactly call it hacked.
So they came back with a, all right, we've now got this IP number scheme. And if you actually read some of the news accounts, just do an exit search for Edelman and iCraig2D, that's Ben's last name. They'll pop up, and you'll see that Ben actually, on the stand, described how he had gotten around their security system, and they figured if Ben could do it, pretty much anybody else could. The defendants actually said, absolutely not. The fact that Ben could do it doesn't mean a thing, because Ben has special expertise that most of our users know.
Well, it turned out that other sites, Streambox.com, for example, were deep linking and bypassing the registration system.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you don't have to be that smart for that technically set.
And in fact, while iCraig TV site is already defunct, there is a successor site in order, JumpTV.com. And JumpTV is about to try to do the same thing. Check out JumpTV.com. And JumpTV.com is going to be iCraig with this kind of reverse IP address lookup feature. It's just coming soon, but eventually you'll just be able to watch TV on it. And they're going to make sure that Americans can't see it, but others can. And they're going to use something, you mentioned one service, Traceware. There's also BorderControl.com. And just jump into BorderControl.com real quick. Just visit that website. Just want to show it off real quick. And go ahead and notice it says, Border Control welcomes you. You are located in the United States. And there is Old Glory flying proudly for us. It is already determined that we're in the United States. Now, oh, I see. You can see if you're coming from jz.org, you can ask in what country. Jz, oh, there's the United States again. And there's the IP address for my own Empire's web server. If you, maybe at least you can jump to an optimizer and then try to see the computer something out. But basically, it's trying to get a handle on where people are checking in from. And with this, you can enable a kind of zone. Now, this is actually an important lesson because the repeat argument we see in case after case, once you're past the procedural jurisdiction problem, and that is a problem to be sure, once you're past it and you get into the substantive jurisdiction problem, where you say it's unfair for that Tennessee woodworker to have to abide by all of these interlocking laws. Suddenly it's as if the Tennessee woodworker with a homepage is a multinational corporation selling infant formula in all sorts of countries and having to abide by the complicated import-export regs of each country. The answer by the courts traditionally has either been, you're right, we're going to abstain from doing any assertion of substantive law over this person unless they live where we are, because it would just be unfair. Or they say, too bad. Too bad we're going to combine all our laws. Oops. And it still knows we're in the United States because presumably anonymizer itself is located in the United States. Although we don't seem to be treated for flags just yet. So the answer had been, before an ad disastrum argument that says, if you try to impose your law on us, everybody's going to try to impose their law on us, and I'm going to have to go out of business, and that's bad. That's an argument that spoke to Congressman Coble as he thought about things. This is a way of splitting the baby, because suddenly you can say, I will open my website only to certain visitors on a jurisdictional basis. My website is open to members of the European Union, to Americans, to Canadians, but not to anybody coming from the Asian continent, because I don't like their laws, I don't have to be subject to their laws. And suddenly, you can see governments demanding of those who have websites that are accessible from within their borders that they use particular laws. And if they don't like it, they don't have to close up shop, they simply have to turn off the spigot and prevent access from within the borders of the country by those who live there. Now, IP address may be a relatively crude metric of determining geographic location. I don't know, Andrew, how
it's more than just crude. So the way that it works is that an ISP goes to a regionally based internet registry to get a big block of numbers. So for example, AT&T goes to a registry in Virginia called Aaron, says I like a big block of numbers. AT&T then distribute those numbers anywhere around the world.
So AT&T could give it to somebody in Europe and it would still be flying an American flag on the bordercontrol.com site.
Absolutely. I mean, if AT&T registers it in the name of its headquarters in the U.S., then they all show up as U.S.-based IP addresses. But of course, U.S.-based is sort of irrational in this context because for the reasons I just said, there is no geographic meaning ultimately to an IP address.
Even though you get the sense that actually bordercontrol.com would get it right more often than not?
With research, you could do it. But for example, when I've gone into AT&T account out of Europe, there's no way to distinguish where I am simply on the basis of that IP address, unless AT&T agrees to share with border control the way that it parses out the sub-branches of its IP address tree.
Gotcha. So this then leaves an open question for us. The open question is, we had a presumption that the internet was inherently boundaryless. Wherever you were was pretty much the same as wherever else you might be. The internet you see in China is the same internet you see in the United States. Now we see that there are some ways, however imperfect, of starting to get a sense of where people are and what jurisdiction they are. And indeed, sharing a suggestion of passport number, you can imagine some way of being able to assert your identity with some encryption data. Being able to assert your identity and your citizenship. Maybe not being able to say, this is where I am right now, but this is the country of which I am a citizen. And when that happens, you can imagine an internet explicitly zoned so that those who provide information know to give it to some and not to others, even on the basis of citizenship, on the basis of physical location, on the basis of age. People under 18 see one thing. People who can certify that they are over 18 can see another, and we get an internet that is suddenly quite fragmented. I've been given a note that says either Edie, Min, or Admin. I'm going to take it as the latter, and let John and Becca go over some administrative notes before I utter a final sentence in class.
Sorry to interrupt the interesting part with that, but just three really quick things. One, some people have expressed interest in doing a class for the instead of the final paper. We've received at least one formal proposal for it. If you would like to do the class instead of the paper, if you could please give to Becca and me or myself a proposal. Very short, it doesn't have to be extensive, but ideally with one or two people's names on it. The requirements of doing the class are prepare reading materials, to develop the registry questions, to help with the guest panel, if appropriate, and you will have to meet with Jonathan at least once or twice to plan the class in advance. Secondly, if you are struggling with a paper topic issue, obviously talk to us, or if you would like to find somebody to do your paper with, there is a folder on the discussion page that says, you know, I have an idea but no partner, and we urge you to post there. And lastly, anybody who is interested in politics and the web, you might be interested in going to the Institute of Politics Forum tomorrow night, Wednesday, 7 p.m. Our own John Citrain is moderating a panel with Dick Morris, famous former presidential advisor and author of the great new book called Vote.com, and Jacob Weisberg from Slate. That's tomorrow at 7 o'clock. The IOP forum.
Just two more quick things. One other thing that might be helpful if you're looking for someone to write a paper with is we suggest that you, anyone who's interested, gather in the lobby right outside the doors after this and just take some time to see who else is out there and wants to write a paper with you. And the other thing is that our own John Palfrey is actually going to be participating on a panel at the Heinz Convention Center that, of course, the topic is the EPA. The environmental internet, and so in case anybody's interested in attending John's panel, you should talk to him after and figure out when and where, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, before the notebooks start clicking, two final things. One thing is, what is the one thing? Yes, the discussion forum is somewhat dead on arrival. I have no intention to sort of chase into for that. It's yours to use or not to use, please. And it's somewhat awkward to use the web-based sort of discussion forum. I am happy if there is interest to set up a major Domo mailing list for use by the class for discussion. That means every time somebody sends a list, ping, it goes into your email box. If you set up your filtering properly, it actually doesn't hurt when the ping comes. But I just want to get a hum. How many would be interested in having a major Domo list set up of the class for discussion rather than the web discussion forum? All right, so we'll do it. I hear consensus. To wrap up, these were the questions we had in grade. These are some of the issues we went to. Figuring out the procedural limits is still somewhat of a difficult conundrum, but contract really helps getting people, even though it seems to be under some form of duress, to waive whatever jurisdictional complaint they might have. You want the domain name, you agree to proceed to speech. On the substantive limits, one answer we saw for the UDRP was to unify it under a sui generis scheme. Just come up with your own independent body of jurisprudence universally to govern stuff under a particular thing. Whether that's applicable to a whole lot of other areas is unclear. Another thing to do is just to say start zoning or stop complaining. As a provider of information on the net, if you want it to have worldwide reach, you've got to be prepared to subject yourself to worldwide jurisdiction, especially as we enter a world in which you can cherry pick what jurisdictions you want to have open to you or not. And finally, how can the sovereign's power effectively be done? Well, you've got cyber remedies, control over whether somebody has a domain name, control over whether they've got internet access, versus the regular remedies. The former one, cyber remedies are much easier to assert in the cyberspace than the regular ones, like putting someone in jail after finding them. But we're going to talk about that on John Doe and Jane Doe Day on October 16th. Next week, we do the free software movement and trusted systems, which are an examination of the way the technology plays into this rather than just the law. With that, goodbye. See you soon.